The Vietnam War, it's over. Your job just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hello, Next Picture Show listeners. Here's our friendly reminder that if you enjoy the Next Picture Show, you'll really enjoy getting more Next Picture Show by subscribing to our Patreon. You can get our weekly newsletter for $3 a month and unlock bonus episodes for $5 a month. To subscribe to our Patreon, please visit patreon.com/nextpictureshow.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Keith Phipps, here again with
Scott Tobias
and Tosh Robinson.
Jenny Kosky is not with us. She is on another coast, unfortunately, and we hope to visit her at holidays. In our last episode, we discussed Robert Benton's Best Picture-winning 1979 film Kramer vs. Kramer, a wrenching drama that freezes in time and airs concern about the state of the American marriage. Released 40 years later, Marriage Story doesn't carry quite the same burden. As the movie itself depicts, divorce hasn't gotten easier, but it has grown less novel. Over the course of Baumbach's film, both Nicole, an actress played by Scarlett Johansson, and her husband Charlie, a playwright and theater director played by Adam Driver, learn about the culture, rituals, and mechanisms that have grown up around the industry of divorce. She wants to live in California. He sees them as a New York family. To find a compromise between these seemingly incompatible goals, they surround themselves with lawyers, family, and friends, none of whom have much interest in depicting the other side as anything but the bad guy in the process. As the couple sinks deeper into their camps, any remaining connection between them starts to fray. And as they grow increasingly determined to win the case, the chances that they'll find a resolution in the best interest of their 8-year-old son Henry becomes more distant. To depict this, Baumbach keeps the focus on the drama's key moments. An attempt at normality when Charlie visits Nicole's family in California, visits to lawyers who offer pragmatic but borderline heartless advice about how to proceed, a one-on-one confrontation that begins civilly and ends in screams and tears, and, in the end, a few fleeting moments of grace and understanding. We'll talk it all over after the break.
Charlie and I are getting a divorce, Mom. You can't be friends with him anymore.
Gee, Mom.
Charlie Bird.
Mom. Mom. Mom.
What?
You know, most people in my business, you're just transactions to them. I like to think of you as people.
Oh, okay, good.
You remind me of myself on my second marriage.
Baby, I'm amazed the way you love me all the time.
Part of what we're gonna do together is tell your story.
Did you dye your hair again?
No, this is me. You don't like it?
Is it shorter? I prefer it longer, but...
How are you doing?
If we start from a place of reasonable and they start from a place of crazy, when we settle, we'll be somewhere between reasonable and crazy.
All right. What are everyone's first impressions? I thought it was a remarkable film. How does everybody else feel?
I think it's a masterpiece. I think it's Baumbach's best movie. It's one of the best films I've seen this year. It's so full of insight and humor and it's and heartbreak. But I think one of the things that really impresses me about it is I think it's full of optimism and a quite different attitude about divorce and the result of divorce than you got out of The Squid and the Whale, which seems like kind of its companion piece in a way from much earlier. I think Baumbach has gotten to a point where he understands divorce as certainly a painful process, but also a catalyst for change, and a change that is not ultimately unwelcome or without its benefits and without resolutions that can help a person grow and become better and happier. So I don't know. It's funny, people talk about how wrenching this film is, and I think I would agree. It is a very emotional film. It's a film that kills me on several different scenes, but I come out of it feeling kind of good. It's kind of a feel-good movie for me. I don't know, because I think the attitude of the movie is constructive and positive, and I think that's part of it is Baumbach's changed perspective, and it's also just the fullness of these characters in the world that he's built for them, and that the actors have built as well.
It took me a while to warm to this film. It's more than 2 hours long, 2 hours 15, and it's parts of it are grueling, and parts of it feel a little stagey to me, a little much like with Kramer versus Kramer, a little calculated for injustice and misery and strong feeling, sometimes a little seemingly at the expense of human feeling. But it got the way it builds, I think, is just masterful. I'm Scott and I've argued about the whole Baumbach's best film thing. I will cede nothing to my love for The Squid and the Whale.
Yeah.
But
it's great. It's like my second favorite, so it's fine.
It's not very much of an argument. But yeah, by the time you get to the end of the story and the point where Adam Driver is singing a song from Company to his friends, and it becomes like a statement of purpose and a statement of life. I mean, I cried in the theater at TIFF. I was in that mode of, all right, it's yet another movie that I'm jamming into my eyeballs and my brain. And then that moment was the moment that I thought about for the next 3 months, I think.
The being alive.
The being alive, yeah, oh my God. Singing sequence.
Yeah.
So it reflected the rest of the movie back at me in just a completely different light, like the vividness of it and the sort of the construction of the emotions. And I'm still waiting for it to be to feel less raw so I can go back and watch it again. But I think it has flaws that we're going to talk about. But I also think it's just very powerfully acted. And boy, is it emotional. Boy, is it effective as an emotional story.
I feel like they know what they have with this movie, too. Like at the publicity screening we saw, I got a little Marriage Story branded container Kleenex. but I mean, there's a quote we've had before, the Howard Hawks quote about how a good movie is three great scenes and no bad ones. This is like one great scene after another. I feel like there's just one kind of perfect, self-contained, beautifully constructed scene kind of stacked on top of another until it forms like this really coherent piece of storytelling. It's remarkable. I mean, I'm a Baumbach fan. I don't know if it's, is it my favorite of his? I don't know. But it's certainly way up there. It's quite an achievement. And it's a little bit of a, you know, we were talking before, a little bit of a departure for him in terms of style. And I think that's not to bring it in too early, but I think there might be a little bit of Kramer versus Kramer influence there where there is sort of the matter of letting scenes play out and, you know, not rushing anything and just kind of living in the moment.
Yeah, and there's this kind of a real swing for the fences. I mean, it that isn't really in the Baumbach way. I mean, I think he's somebody who likes to just kind of get into the dirt of things and isn't somebody who's going to give you a story on this scale. I mean it's a personal, intimate story, but it's on a big canvas. I mean, it's across two coasts and it's 135 minutes long and it has some pretty big set pieces in it. It's a different film for him in that respect. And I can tell you, you mentioned the whole three great scenes and no bad scenes. I mean, I think there's plenty of great scenes in the movie, but I can tell you what the three great scenes in the movie are.
Go.
One is the first scene with Scarlett Johansson and Laura Dern in Laura Dern's office. These are the long scenes too, right? Mm-hmm. Where Nicole goes over the whole story of her marriage, basically, and why she's gotten to this place where she needs a divorce. And all that's beautifully handled and affecting, and it's just a wonderful dynamic between Johansson and Laura Dern, who's just like such an MVP in almost everything she does. She's so funny and so sharp in this movie. And also she has, I think, the key line in the film, which is telling her client that what she's doing is an act of hope. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a really, really smart and kind of something that she says is a sales pitch, which is actually kind of sincere. The second scene is, of course, the big showdown in his apartment in Los Angeles, where they've been through all of this confrontation already, and they're just kind of try to figure out how to maybe go back to dealing with things on their own, and they can't. And it just ends at these bitter recriminations and tears, and you get something particularly out of Adam Driver it's almost historic. Like, it's like it would be a performance in a moment that's going to be talked about forever, I think. And then, of course, Being Alive, which is so powerful. I spent a lot of this week just kind of like looking at old other performances of that song, you know, first in the soundtrack recording of Company, which was
the original cast album.
The original cast album, which was the D.A. Pennebaker film. And I saw Bernadette Peters do a version. I saw another Sondheim tribute version that I think a lot of people feel is like the definitive version. But I tell you, you know, the emotional context of this movie, and then the fact that what is being expressed is so much comes out of character, makes the Driver performance the most powerful because it's such, you know, you've been through hell, to quote the lyrics with him, and you know, his resolve in that moment is so piercing. I love it.
I think I'd quibble a little on one of those scenes. Like, if we have to break it down to the three great scenes that make the movie, I would pick the second two that you mentioned, and for the first one, not the Laura Dern divorce conversation, but that opening, that sequence, it feels almost like a Malick film, that the voiceover and just watching the two of them at work and at play, like together with their kid, and like getting this spelled out idea of what the relationship is like, and then cutting to the understanding that all of that is over, and that this beautiful, like, sort of tone poem kind of description of what their relationship is and why they love each other is a depressing exercise in remembering that they used to love each other as the beginnings for a breakup. I think that's so challenging and daring, and it's like, it's an emotional reversal on the level of the opening of Up. It's just a gutting leap from what a beautiful relationship to what a over relationship.
Yeah. But and the fact that they don't actually say those, that all that is a fake out in a way, because Nicole refuses to read from her letter, and Charlie doesn't read from his letter, and so they don't know.
But it is booking at the end when the letter comes back, and I think, to speak to what you were just saying, it's like, yes, it's gone, but it did happen, and it was real, and that's meaningful, and they're all moving on from it, but it was a real thing. Another scene, as long as we're just cataloging great scenes, I love the scene where Charlie first comes to visit in California, and everyone's trying to be normal about it, but at the same time they have to serve in papers, you know.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
That's just a really great, I'm just an act of choreography. It's pretty great. But also, I mean, when you have, like, you know, not only Scarlett Johansson, but you have
Merritt Weaver
and Julie Haggerty running around, you know, it's great stuff.
I swear to God, I'm so, the ensemble cast of this movie, I just love so much. I mean, Julie Haggerty, God, thank you so much for casting Julie Haggerty. I love her. She's always so funny, and she's so distinctive. Alan Alda, like, God, thank you. And Ray Liotta, like, it's just, everything is so inspired and unexpected. And you see a lot of actors you don't see that much anymore that are not given that kind
Wallace
of
Wallace Shawn
kind of
has some amazing moments too.
No, I mean, it's Wallace
such
Shawn,
a small role.
Wallace Shawn, you expect
but come on.
Everything. It's almost a fake out. I like when Ray Liotta shows up, it's interesting, because when these characters, like, are, especially when Adam Driver's character is checking out a series of lawyers, like, there's always sort of a feeling of, all right, well, I don't know this guy, he's not super famous, so we're not going to stick with him. And then when he shows up with Alan Alda, it's like, oh, well, of course he's found his guy. Like, we're not just going to have him here for a minor moment. But Wallace Shawn kind of gives the lie to that. Like, Wallace Shawn, as soon as he shows up, you're like, oh, he's going to be a major part of the movie. And it's like, no, we threw him in because we have a few lines and we realized we could get Wallace Shawn to do them, and it would be just way funnier.
And you just kind of, like, understand him as a fixture of the New York theater scene.
Sure.
And he just immediately gives that a world authenticity. It was great to see a lot of these actors in the movie, and it's interesting to see, like, you know, that relationship, these little individual relationships, like the one between Charlie and Nicole's mom, played by Julie Haggerty. They have a closeness.
It's very sweet.
It's sweet, and there's some really interesting specific details to the Julie Haggerty character, which is, you know, having to do with her own marriage to a husband who was gay, and yet she continued having a friendship or a friendly relationship with his lover after he died. And I mean, it's just, I feel like all of that is so real, and her, you know, and even her perspective on it and the way that's changed, that was all real too. I mean, it's so full of wonderful small observations, this movie. And just, I think he just knows. One thing that's been a constant in Baumbach's work from Squid and the Whale on is the fact of divorce, is the fact of families that are unconventional, that are discontinuous, and that it's okay, you know, and that weird relationships can form. I mean, you think about Mistress America, you know, that's about a relationship between two characters whose parents fail to get married. I mean, that's a very interesting thing, right? Mm-hmm. And the moment in all of his movies that touches me the most probably is that piano sequence at the beginning of the Meyerowitz stories with Adam Sandler and his daughter, because you think about, this is a song that was written a long time ago when they were all a family, because it's like Mommy and Daddy and Genius Girl is the name of the song. Well, Mommy's out of the picture. and that's what gets you at first. You're at first kind of affected by the fact that, you know what? They're singing this song to each other. Mommy's out of the picture. But then the other thing that strikes you is like, it's okay. Like, it's not something that either one of them is getting stuck on, you know, and they can still kind of appreciate this song that they've created together and kind of appreciate this moment that they're having before she goes off to college. And it's touching in that way too. So I just think he's kind of, you know, this accumulated experience and obviously a lot of personal things that have happened to him in his life is, you know, all fed into this big vision.
I also feel like Baumbach just comes back over and over to the idea of pettiness in his films. The idea that when people feel that they need something, or when people do need something emotionally, they can be extremely petty in like these small and nasty little ways, and they can be aware of how petty they're being and still not be able to fight it. They can harm other people and be aware that they're harming other people and still not be able to fight it. And I think that that's such an interesting idea to explore. And here with Marriage Story, I'm thinking primarily of the Halloween scene and the frustration of like, why won't he wear my costume? Like, we had plans. Why can't we follow through with my plans? Taking this reluctant child out trick or treating a second time, mm-hmm. because he's owed, like he needs this. And he understands that everybody is going to see him as being petty and obnoxious, but he has to do it anyway. He understands that his child is tired and doesn't necessarily want to do this, but he has to do it anyway. And it feels so real. And you look at things like the composition of Hey You in Squid and the Whale, mm-hmm. or the Meyerowitz stories where the siblings find out that their sister was sexually assaulted and they feel a burning need to do something about it after the fact, even when she's telling them that's not what she wants and that they should be listening to her, that they should be letting her process in her own way rather than demanding that they be allowed to do something about it. There's just this sense.
Smash an old man's car.
And Frances Ha is all about petty needs and somebody like exploring her own petty needs and unable to escape them. I feel like you could come up with a lot more examples, especially from While We're Young or Greenberg.
Yeah, like Greenberg. Greenberg talked about Margot at the wedding. My God.
These are in some ways, because maybe I'm looking at it too small, and maybe the connection here is emotional arrested development and people working their way through it. But fundamentally, all of these stories just have these moments of, I want something in a childish 2-year-old kind of way. I want to skip dinner and eat ice cream. And I can't stop myself from expressing that because it's something I need in a very raw way. And I think that just the way he keeps coming back to these ideas is fascinating.
And I think there's a lot of integrity to him, too, in that he seems to actively resist ingratiating himself to an audience. He'll go the other way. He'll be like, let me see how much I can challenge, you know, how much I can put people off, you know, deflect their sympathies and challenge them to like characters even when they're not behaving as you might want them to. And there's plenty of examples here. I mean, the Halloween thing is definitely a good one. And there's another one where Charlie gets frustrated by the kid refusing to get in the car, not wanting to get in the car. And he swears, you know, he swears and yells at him and tells him he needs to get in and bleep, bleep, bleep. You know, he's just furious. So it's like these are, he kind of steers right into those character flaws. And I appreciate that because, you know, we don't often get that. We often get the opposite where it's like movies just want us so much to love the people in them. It's so critical. And it becomes quite boring.
Can we talk about who we love in this movie? Like I know that now I can't remember if we've talked about it or who I've talked about it with, but the broad range of like reviews and responses that are like, oh, he's so terrible and the movie's so one-sided against him. Oh, she's so terrible and the movie's so one-sided against her. Hmm. Like people interpret the movie is unbalanced, but seem to be completely divided over who it's unbalanced for. Do you guys see this movie as fair and balanced, or is it slanted toward one of the characters?
It's an inkblot, isn't it? I feel like it's pretty even-handed, but I feel like we spend more time with Charlie and attending to Charlie and concerning ourselves with what Charlie needs and how he's been hurt. It does take into account Nicole's feelings and Nicole's ways she's been hurt and what she wants as well. And to the point where, you know, just the, you know, she could come off as monstrous just by taking the kid to California possibly with the intent of establishing residency there, but even if it's not the intent, it is the result of that move. But it does, you know, it's I think it's okay with her. I think it's okay with both of them.
I think there's something about her that's not calculating. I mean, as you're saying about, it is a result of her wanting to go to Los Angeles and to pursue that part of her for herself that has been lost in this marriage. The result of that is a residency issue. But you don't see that as a, like a shrewd, heartless move on her part to kind of gain extra leverage in this proceeding.
Others.
I don't agree with that.
No, I mean, others within the film presented as that as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's another point about the movie, too, is that one of the central ideas of the movie is that the process of divorce, you know, brings out the worst in the people who have to go through with it. And what becomes difficult and what the film ultimately finally achieves is two people finally, you know, getting to that point where they were supposed to be at the beginning, writing those letters of like recognizing that this was somebody that they loved so much that they married, you know, and that they, and who has these wonderful qualities that haven't disappeared as a result of the marriage falling apart. So if you can remember those things, that's great. But the process of divorce really makes it hard for people to acknowledge each other's humanity.
For me, at least, though, I mean, I do see a bias in the film towards Charlie and against Nicole. And in large part, that's just because of her narrative function. Like, she keeps moving the goalposts. And I don't think that we spend nearly as much time understanding why she keeps moving the goalposts as we spend understanding its emotional effect on Charlie. The sequence where she sits down with Laura Dern is very explanatory and very helpful in terms of unpacking where she is and why she does what she does. But after that, I feel like the movie kind of loses her a bit, at least up until the big confrontation. She keeps doing these things. Basically, she keeps breaking her word. She keeps saying, you know, we're not going to bring lawyers into this. We're going to do it the easy way. And then she doesn't. She keeps saying, we'll do it this way, and then changing her mind. She does weird, petty things that I don't think are supposed to come across as power plays, like getting their son a costume and taking him trick-or-treating and then making Charlie out to be the bad guy when he wants what he was promised. But we don't really understand necessarily why she's doing these things. I think there's a point in the movie where she becomes a little opaque and just kind of turns into a straw woman of, she's just going to keep making decisions that could be seen as very selfish and very heartless. And I don't think the movie ignores her humanity or her needs, but I do think it has her make a lot of decisions that we don't really understand that are extremely hurtful and extremely harmful.
I think you're probably right in terms of balance, but I think what you end up gaining is point of view. You know, I can think about, like, if Baumbach or if the filmmaker becomes too obsessed with that question of balance of, like, well, of doing the he said, she said thing and of getting it exactly schematically right, that you just lose the kind of flow of the film. And I think if we're given the fact that this is a film by Noah Baumbach, you know, it's a personal film and however way you want to think about it, that, you know, you're gonna maybe spend more time with Charlie. This is the bottom line. And I think at the very least, I think there's a lot of time that is given to her to try to explain herself. I mean, we'll talk about it in comparison with Kramer versus Kramer, but like, she, I think her reasons for wanting to end the marriage are completely understandable and interesting in modern, in a way of just like, here's somebody who's not an ogre, really, Charlie, but who has steered their lives, you know, entirely on his own, you know, ambitions. I mean, his ambitions and his artistry has been kind of the guiding force, and it's taken a lot away from her, chipped away at it over the years, and she's trying to claim it back while she still can, and all that felt very real, I think.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you mentioned Kramer versus Kramer. We should probably actually shift on to making connections, which we will do after this short break.
You always made me aware of what I was doing wrong, how I was falling short. Life with you was joyless.
What, so then you had to go and fuck someone else?
You shouldn't be upset that I fucked her. You should be upset that I had a laugh with her.
Do you love her?
No, but she didn't hate me. You hated me.
You hated me. You fucked somebody we worked with.
You stopped having sex with me in the last year. I never cheated on you.
That was cheating on me.
But there's so much I could have done. I was a director in my 20s who came from nothing and was suddenly on the cover of fucking Time Out New York. I was hot shit and I wanted to fuck everybody and I didn't. and I loved you and I didn't want to lose you, but I'm in my 20s and I didn't want to lose that too, and I kind of did. And you wanted so much, so fast, I didn't even want to get married. Fuck it! There's so much I didn't do.
Thanks for that.
You're welcome.
Now it's time for connections when we bring these two films together and talk about all the things they have in common. I think they have a lot in common. I think also Baumbach is certainly someone who would be aware of Kramer versus Kramer. It's sort of definitely an influence into this film as well.
Definitely. I mean, and it's absolutely fascinating on every level. I mean, we could maybe just start with the legal aspects of the movie. You know, I mean, because it is 40 years later.
Yeah, it seems like it's turned into sophisticated, kind of like the wedding industry. It's the divorce industry where the whole, like, these sophisticated mechanisms have grown up around divorce.
Yeah.
And yet the mechanic seems to be the exact same thing of the lawyer saying up front, this is going to cost you way more money than you want to pay, way mm-hmm. more money than you can probably afford. And basically, I'm going to have to be as cruel as possible. It's going to be gutting to you. And you're also going to have to spend your life savings on it. And then a character kind of has to, you know, swallow that. Both films like make a point of having that scene of, oh, this is going to cost you tragically in terms of emotion and also money.
And both films are pretty interesting in the courtroom scenes in bringing up specific instances of a lack of fitness
that reflect very badly on, yeah. you know, taken out of context or presented in
yeah.
without context.
The other thing is that you sense from all parties that they've gone way too far, that their mm-hmm. lawyers have gone way too far, but the stakes are so high because you're talking about custody of a kid that you can't do what your instinct is, which is to say, no, this is that's too much. To say that Nicole has a drinking problem, that's too far. That's not really how things really are. But if you weaken your case, you know, by objecting, then you lose something much more substantial, which is access to your kid.
Yeah, I think both of these films openly let the separated couple reconnect through empathy for each other because of what their opposing lawyers do. Like, both of them have them kind of reaching across the aisle just in a, no matter what we're going through now, like, you're somebody whose emotions I used to care about and on some level still care about, and you're being hurt a lot by this outsider, by this stranger. And the fact that I'm paying them my life savings to make them hurt you mm-hmm. is immaterial to the moment of just wanting to comfort you.
You know, we get to know the lawyers a lot more in this one as well. They are collectively figure in quite prominently, but I think it's just sort of a general change of attitude toward the proceedings. Like, you know, it is the first, Kramer is very much a man fighting against a system that does not want to award him custody because that's just not what it does. And this is a different stage of divorce at this point as well.
Divorce Inc. One of the things I appreciate about Marriage Story is, I mean, these are people who have to deal with this is what they do for a living. They deal with divorce. They deal with each other. Mm-hmm. And so they're scrapping, you know, in front of a judge for the highest of stakes, but then they're also quite chummy and they're ordering sandwiches and they're saying hi to each other and asking about each other's spouses or something in the hallway. And I'm reminded of one of my favorite bits from the TV show Homicide, the one episode with Robin Williams. Do you ever see that
yeah.
episode? There's a bit where all the homicide guys are just talking about the case, which is a very heartbreaking case, and they're just laughing and, you know, they're at their jobs and making jokes.
Yeah,
and
then he wanders in
and yeah. he's just utterly crushed by it. And of course they're embarrassed, but at the same time, the point is, like, that's what they do for a living. You know, they're around this all the time. All they deal with is death. And so they're going to, the language they use is not going to be, would seem appropriate to people who are on the outside.
Right. To the couple, it's one of the most profound things that's ever happened to them. And for the lawyers, it's just another case to get through.
Yeah. But at the same time, I think there's humanity there and real connection.
Sure. I mean, you know, Laura Dern's character is, you know, an expert operator who knows all the angles, but she also appreciates Charlie's play. She's, you know, she's probably this, you know, a smart, sensitive person. It's just, she's also very good at this particular nasty job.
Yeah, she's also both competitive and a little hateful. I mean, we get that moment at the end where she's like, I made sure I got 55-45 because I didn't want him to win.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's still competitive. She's still in this industry and as expensive as she is because she's cutthroat. And I think that the film almost maybe spends too much time with her and too much time on her character in a way that maybe is a little imbalancing, because she comes across, this is a character that we would probably have like a full episode devoted to if this was like a miniseries or a TV show. This is a character that the story cares a lot about. And I almost feel like we know a little too much about her comparatively how much we know about Nicole's emotions in the middle going. Like we know a lot about her sympathies and her feelings and her backstory and where she is at every given moment of the movie. And I think it's a really interesting like place for Baumbach to be interested in focusing.
But it gets to this question too with her with regard to gender roles, which is another connection between these movies, because for her, for Laura Dern's character, you know, there's a scene where she stops Nicole from expressing maternal ambivalence, because that's something that is always held against women and never held against men. And I think that kind of accounts for that moment you were talking about towards the end, where it's like, well, I want to win a little bit, you know, I got 55-45, I want it to win. And there's something, I think those elements are kind of connected in that character of just like there's some systemic issue that she is engaged in that goes far beyond this one specific case and has to do with her mission, I guess, as a divorce lawyer who is thinking of, all the time about gender roles and how what's expected of wives and mothers.
Yeah, she absolutely comes across as somebody who cares about Nicole personally and her story personally, but she's also fighting for women, yeah, like in the abstract. She is fighting for a broad swathing ideal that exists in her head. And, you know, being chummy with opposing counsel doesn't get in the way of the fact that like this is an ideal for her.
We could also talk about just depictions of day-to-day parenting, which this has a lot of, as well as Kramer versus Kramer. And that I think that may be, if not an influence, at least sort of a way it echoes Kramer versus Kramer, is you do just get a lot of Charlie going about the routines of being a dad. And this time under trying circumstances, you get the feeling that he was more involved in the actual day-to-day parenting than Dustin Hoffman in Kramer versus Kramer. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he's in a lot of situations that place that under stress. I think it's very good. Narrative story is very good about showing how Henry falls into a new routine at his mom's, at his grandmother's house. I mean, just, it becomes the new normal for him, and he adjusts very quickly because kids can do that. But he can't necessarily revert back to the way things were in New York. But I mean, what struck me is like the scenes of them driving from lawyer to lawyer, and of course the Halloween scene where it's just so much of parenting is about being frustrated and then feeling bad about being frustrated because you know your kid can only, you know, your kid has limitations because they're a kid. And I think this gets that right in much the same way that Kramer versus Kramer does.
I think both of these films are very, very interesting and very frank about the fact that kids can be pretty amoral. Like kids want what they want. Kids have a very immediate and very simplistic need that doesn't get into the complicated nuance of, I'm feeling disaffected as a father because of this complicated situation that I'm going through that questions both my masculinity and my capability. Like the kid doesn't know that. The kid sees his mom, who he hasn't seen in a long time, and runs to her and forgets about his dad for a minute. And it leaves Dustin Hoffman in a very raw place. The kid in Marriage Story has already been trick-or-treating and he's tired and he wants to eat his candy. Like he doesn't want to get in the car. Like he's not processing like all of these complicated adult things that we're seeing. And in both cases, we see fathers that just go to a place. Again, it's kind of that pettiness, but just such a relatable, understandable pettiness of like, my life has revolved around this child. This child is such an important thing in my life. And this child takes me for granted because they're a child. And those moments of what the kid needs right now is not to support and validate you emotionally. The kid just wants what he wants. I think in both cases, it feels like a really raw thing that you maybe don't see enough of in film. It's just that pain of being a parent and wanting something from your kid that they're not really emotionally equipped to give you and that maybe it's not their responsibility to give you.
It is interesting. One of the things, this is getting back to gender roles again, but I really Would you compare these two films and how they deal with fatherhood specifically? It is interesting to see what that baseline is in terms of what's expected. You know, I mean, Dustin Hoffman is put in a position in Kramer versus Kramer where he has to learn how to do everything because he's never done anything. You can't make a piece of French toast. Whereas, you know, Adam Driver, you know, Charlie is capable of looking after his kid. You know, doesn't need Nicole to help him do that. He can take care of him. He can take care of business just fine. And so you have that, you at least have that as a starting point and not a complication, which is that has to be overcome. I mean, the arc of Kramer versus Kramer is Hoffman's character learning to become a more fully rounded and competent caregiver, you know, because he wasn't before.
Yeah.
That's not what Marriage Story is about.
That's a change in attitude too, where it's like, you know, the subtext of Kramer versus Kramer, both within the film and then sort of the understanding of the audience in 1979 was like a dad who's also the parent, you know, and you don't get that with Marriage Story.
I mean, Three Men and a Baby, that was 7 years after.
Mr. Mom,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, those were after Kramer versus Kramer.
This was a stay-at-home dad? question mark.
It's possible. But now those are period pieces. Now you look back and you say, I mean, I wouldn't say that those roles have been so completely upended, but they're different. And
it doesn't feel like science fiction anymore.
No, not at all. But it was interesting to see that contrast. I mean, I think it's true. I mean, that surely Baumbach knows this film well. Knows Kramer versus Kramer well, and it was able to kind of use it as something to keep elements of it to keep and discard and whatever on based on his own observations and experiences, you know, as a 21st century person.
I think another thing that these films have in common that's pretty interesting is both of them are pretty interested in creation. Kramer versus Kramer spends a lot less time on Ted's focus on creating advertisement, creating art. But we do keep getting back to the elements of his photos that need retouching, his presentations that he's designing, his ad copy that he's writing, the various companies and like what they do with these things and how they care about them. And then in Marriage Story, we kind of have that feeling of both of them are trying to create art, but is that art good in either case? Like I feel like we're told over and over that Adam Driver's character is creating like big, important art that's like well received on the indie scene and wins him awards and whatnot, and that poor Scarlett Johansson has had to just sublimate like all of her talent into helping make him famous. And then we kind of make fun of the TV pilot that she's involved in when she goes off and does her own thing. But both of them are kind of creators, and both of them are pretty absorbed in the importance of their act of creation. I think it's interesting that we see just a little bit of the play that Adam Driver is doing, starring his wife, and it honestly doesn't look great. You know, it looks like a kind of insufferable
avant-garde
black box poetry kind of thing.
I think it looks okay. I'd watch it.
I mean, I'd watch it too, just to see what's going on with it. But I almost always think it's a mistake to show the art in a film that's about how the creation of art is so important, because you're going to end up judging it one way or the other.
Yeah, I mean, I think the TV show is treated as a figure, as an object of some fun, but it also is her ability, it gives her the ability to grow, and by the end she's directing, which is a big deal. And that's, you know, it may not be the path that he would have chosen for her, insofar as that character is even interested in his wife's creative growth, but it's what she needs.
Yeah, it justifies that initial impulse of hers too, and that she really did need to for this marriage to end, for her life to begin, or for her to more fully realize her life as she might have envisioned it before, and that he was not willing to compromise enough to let her explore.
And we get the same thing with Kramer versus Kramer when we find out that Meryl Streep's character has gone off and become like a fashion line designer, and she's actually making more money than Ted is. One of my favorite like little subtle moments in the film is when she says what her salary is, you see him flinch just a little bit because he knows she's making more money than him now, and it hurts his masculinity. But again, it's the exact same sort of case of like, I needed to get away from you to find myself. And in this case, find myself means doing something creative and remunerative that's apparently valued by people enough to put me in a much more stable place and let me create something that people care about.
We should talk about custody and what it means in each of these films as well, because in Kramer versus Kramer, it is despite the fact that the law does award him some visitation rights, it is all encompassing. It means, you know, this is the parent. This is the person who's going to raise the kid. And here it's about finding some kind of balance between them as well. And I obviously one seems more humane than the other, but it also is harder. I mean, it seems like it's a much harder arrangement to land upon, something that's fair to everybody. And sometimes what's fair to the kid gets lost in that a little bit as well.
The Marriage Story is a much more complicated custody case, even though the custody battle is not necessarily front and center in the way it is in Kramer versus Kramer.
I feel like we learned the ins and outs of how it's done a little bit more, though.
I also feel like in
Marriage Story.
As I said in the previous episode, if they're living in the same city and they're both, you know, active, committed parents, then an equitable custody arrangement seems pretty feasible and not a contentious issue. Whereas in Marriage Story, it is an extremely contentious issue because it's like, where is this kid even going to live? Mm-hmm. You know, New York or L.A.? I mean, that's huge for the parents to be separated geographically. I mean, it's untenable. And so everybody's life has to change, or one of the two lives, either the father or the mother, their life has to completely change in order if they're going to have any kind of relationship with their kid.
I feel like in Kramer versus Kramer, they do edge up to the idea that she's newly re-arrived in New York and there's no guarantee that she's not going back. She found herself in California. The impression that I get is that her job and her center is in California. And it feels to me like the film is suggesting that much as she changed her mind about wanting her son, she's going to change her mind about living in California and move with him. I feel like Baumbach picked that thread up and just expanded on it and made it much more overt. I feel like it's a threat in both cases. It's just a threat that's actually played out in much more detail in Marriage Story. And that, if anything, makes me even more convinced that he was using this as a basis. It feels like an unrung bell in Kramer versus Kramer that's like ringing long and hard in Marriage Story.
I think also, circling back to another part of Baumbach's career, The Squid and the Whale does illustrate how difficult a shared arrangement can be even when you are in the same city.
I know. that is a nightmare joint custody.
Right. And that's certainly closer to the period of Kramer versus Kramer than
but think about
film.
This. Think about what another just great Baumbach detail in that is that arrangement is something that is entirely selfish on the father's part. Right? I mean, that's why it happens the way it does, is because he wants to, it has to do with suiting his needs and his like money situation and where he wants, what he wants to do, much more than it's good for the kids. So that's kind of another little wrinkle, because Squid and the Whale is about nothing if not the Jesse Eisenberg character being, aligning himself with the wrong parent, of embracing the narcissism and misogyny of his father and treating his mother cruelly. And that's the kind of the arc of the movie. But
yeah, we could have easily have done that as a pairing as well, because best not to bring this in too much, but Squid and the Whale is based on his parents' divorce, and this is inspired in some ways by Baumbach's own divorce. And I think loosely, I think probably even more loosely than Squid and the Whale is. But, you know, he's someone who's kind of had both sides of this experience, which is, I think, gives him an interesting perspective.
Yeah, I mean, from the kid to the grown-up, I mean, that's a big shift.
I remember a lot less about how Marriage Story addresses the sort of the kid's feeling outside of a few specific scenes. But I do feel like in Marriage Story, the whole question of custody is maybe less about what's best for the kid, and not even necessarily what's best for Ted. It's just about his understanding that this thing that's become the center of his life could be permanently lost. You know, the closeness that he's developed with his son, understanding the daily ins and outs of his relationship with his son, that with his son's development, is all something that might suddenly become very distant and separated from him. Until that final scene where Streep's character flakes out on motherhood a second time and kind of proves that she's a dilettante at all this and she doesn't know what she wants, there isn't really any indication that she's going to neglect or abuse him. It's not, this is going to be so much worse for the kid, it's a tragedy. It's, I love my child and I'm not going to get to have this closeness with him anymore. Our relationship is fundamentally going to change.
Right. And I think Marriage Story addresses the fact that divorce is going to introduce change no matter how it's conducted. And it involves compromises on all sides. And that Charlie and Henry's relationship is going to be different after this. But to go circle back to the sort of hard-won optimism that Scott referenced, it could be good still. It'll just be different. And that's, that's sort of the bittersweetness of this film that really works. And I think that's a quality that you don't really get for the Kramer versus Kramer. It is more of, relief that Dustin Hoffman wins custody of the kid.
Yeah, it's it's this victory
right,
for one character, and then the other one's sort of cast to the wind.
And in this one, I think it's fighting to something like a draw. It's its own kind of victory in A Marriage Story.
I just end up in a place with both of them. You know, maybe this is me just focusing in the wrong place, the wrong bit of attention. But I just end up angry with both of these films that so much money was wasted on. In Kramer versus Kramer, so much money, so much time, so much pain in order to get back to the status quo. In Marriage Story, so much money, so much time, so much pain wasted in order to get to where they theoretically wanted to be in the first place before the lawyers were brought in, down to a kind of a more or less equitable place of stability, but a place of stability that they maybe could have had without destroying each other's lives and destroying each other's finances.
But just on a very practical level, that would require Charlie to realize he couldn't stay in New York.
Yeah, that's a pretty big.
And yeah, that's like he only.
And this theater company that would dissolve as
right,
well.
Right.
The stakes are pretty high in that decision, which is why you need those lawyers to come in and do their work.
Well, on that, I think feel like we've battled to a draw on these films.
I can't believe that you made me spend $800,000 on this podcast for us to just kind of agree in the end that these are both great movies.
Yeah, they are. They're available in some form too.
They are. Kramer versus Kramer is widely available on streaming services. It's also on DVD and Blu-ray, where it has a hilariously inappropriate cover.
It does. I'm pretty happy the Kramers are very happy on the cover of the Kramer versus Kramer.
Which I realize they just recontextualize an image from the poster of the family, in happier times in a frame, which it's very, the context is everything with that.
Yeah.
But Marriage Story is enjoying a brief theatrical run as we record this, and will be on Netflix December 6th. We'll be right back with your next picture show. Finally, it's time to catch each other up on the films or film-related items we've seen in the interim since our last podcast. We call it Your Next Picture Show in the hopes that it will put some interesting choices on your radar. Tasha, what in the film world has been good for you lately?
Well, I'm going to reach back to something that I saw earlier this year, much earlier this year at Sundance, and knew at the time that I was working for a website that I was not really going to let me write about it. And now I'm at a different website that has already written about it, so I don't get the chance. So when I say that Honey Boy is one of my favorite films of the year, I'm saying that without really much of an opportunity to put a review out there that says that. So you're going to get the... you're going to get the unfiltered version. Best movie of the year. Transcendent! ! Shia LaBeouf, as you've never seen him before. Tosh Robinson, no place in particular. This movie, Shia LaBeouf has fascinated me for a long time. I interviewed him when he was fairly young, I think still a teenager in person. And I found him just really interesting at the time. He said up front, everywhere I go, I'm adopting a persona. It's a persona that's talking to you right now. This isn't really me. And then he went through, so many self-destructive, cyclic phases and so much rehab. And then these strange art experiments that I found very compelling. And now we have him again in a movie that is expressly about what it was like to be him growing up as a child star and what it was like to deal with his father. And he plays his own father. and he is just about unrecognizable. It's one of my favorite performances of the year, Shia LaBeouf playing effectively his own father in this kind of fictionalized narrative about a child star in California, like working his way through hit after hit and being raised and managed by this kind of like irresponsible ne'er-do-well, very opinionated hippie who thinks he's a great dad and is not necessarily a particularly great dad. Shia LaBeouf's performance in this, I think, is just, he disappears into this role. I have no idea if this in any way like looks or feels like his actual father, but it looks and feels like both a stranger and just a really well-realized character. And Noah Jupe playing kind of the young version, kind of the 12-year-old version of Shia LaBeouf, they create this relationship that's in a way reminiscent of the Kramer versus Kramer relationship. It's sometimes contentious. There's sometimes, you know, a young child detesting his father and seeing what he can get away with. You're seeing a child star who's acting out and who's kind of coming of age in this environment that lets him be older than he should be or can be. I think it's just really well nuanced, incredibly well portrayed, very emotional, and just a really interesting experiment of a film.
Between this and Peanut Butter Falcon, which is a hit, I haven't seen it yet. Have you?
That was a hit?
Yeah, it's a quiet, really quiet, big art house hit.
What about that?
Yeah.
I've heard great things about Honey Boy. I'm really stoked to catch it when the screeners are
So LaBeouf's back is what I'm saying.
It's in theaters right now, at least in very select markets. It'll be out further later on, but mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. Some of us may have to rely on screeners. I'm looking forward to watching it again when those screeners come out. So yeah, Honey Boy, starring Shia LaBeouf, very unusual and interesting film. Keith, what's good for you?
What's good for me is a qualified recommendation of an older film I'd never seen before that I liked, but I kind of found myself wishing it was a little bit better, which was the 1979 version of Dracula. Have either of you guys seen that?
Wait, oh,
the John
okay.
Badham, Frank yeah. Langella, Laurence no. Olivier, Donald Pleasance adaptation.
Okay.
It's good. It's clearly an attempt to do like kind of a big blockbuster post-Star Wars, post-Jaws version of Dracula, which is kind of at odds with the source material, which was the stage play that Frank Langella starred in that really emphasized sensuality. I mean, this is young, sexy Frank Langella in this film as a very sensual Dracula. And it's a really good performance, but it's played out in like kind of expressionistic sets, but the stage version was performed on sets designed by Edward Gorey that looked like giant Gorey drawings. And I kind of wish there was a more radical version of this film. The most striking sequence is this kind of blood-sucking consummation sequence between Dracula and the female lead played by Kate Nelligan that was conceptualized and executed largely by Maurice Bender, who you know as the designer of James Bond title sequences for many, many years. And it kind of looks like that. It kind of has this kind of neat 70s psychedelia look to it. I wish the film had been a little more radical in other ways as well, but it's really quite a good adaptation and of Dracula. It's got its own thing going on. Plus, it's got that great cast. But what's interesting about it is now it's coming out on Blu-ray from Scream Factory in two versions. One is the version that people have seen before. The other is the exact same film, but it's in John Badham's preferred color tinting, which is kind of like this desaturated, at times almost black and white imagery, which is really quite different from any version you've seen before. And kind of radical for a 1979 film. I can kind of see why the studio didn't want to go for it, but it's neat to have both options. So Dracula 1979, I would recommend it. Scott, how about you? What would you recommend?
I want to recommend a pretty wild documentary called Cold Case Hammarskjöld.
Oh,
have you seen this, Tasha?
I haven't, but I've heard a great deal about it.
Yeah, it's wild. So here's the backstory on it. In 1961, Dag Hammarskjöld, who was the second ever Secretary General of the United Nations, he and 15 others were killed when his plane crashed over Ndola, northern Rhodesia, which is a country now known as Zambia. And Hammarskjöld was known as a strong advocate for newly independent African countries that were kind of coming out of the shadow of colonialism. And he was all about trying to support those countries. And there was a situation going on in this breakaway state of Katanga that he tried to resolve through force, and was on his way to solve through a peace agreement when his plane went down. And it was attributed to pilot error, but of course there's been many, many conspiracy theories swirling around the case that it was shot down. And so this Danish director named Mads Brügger and a Swedish investigator named Göran Björkdahl, they get together to try to work on this case, which is quite old, as it says, cold case for sure. And he says at the beginning, you know, Brügger says at the beginning of the movie that he could be on to the world's biggest murder mystery or the world's most idiotic conspiracy theory. And the movie really does feel like both at once. It's very silly at times and it's speculation. And there's like a scene where Brügger, you know, dons like this pith helmet and is trying to dig into the actual site of the plane crash. And it's kind of played out for its absurdity. And there's kind of this meta documentary element to it. But at the same time, there's a recognition of the context of this death of this man who had made his mission to be of assistance in to countries that were struggling to find their footing and after independence and being sort of tragically shot down. And so the film is kind of managing a lot of different, it's got a lot of balls in the air, a lot of different tones happening, and it's kind of wacky, but also deep and serious in certain respects as well. A Wild Ride, it just came out on, you know, streaming services, you pay streaming services, though it is Magnolia, so I suspect it will turn up on Netflix eventually, because mm-hmm. I think there's a pretty solid pipeline between Magnolia and Netflix in terms of their features and documentaries, and I recommend checking it out. It's kind of a fun one. Cold Case, Hammarskjöld.
And that's it for this edition of the Next Picture Show. Our next pairing will come out December 17th and 24th as a Christmas present to you. Tasha, what's coming up next?
We're getting our knives out. Specifically, we're looking at Rian Johnson's new movie, Knives Out, which is something like an ensemble comedy in the mode of Clue, which we talked about earlier this year, and something like a murder mystery, and something like a modern class struggle movie. Johnson starts off in a pretty familiar Agatha Christie cozy house mystery mode, then he completely subverts the genre in some fun ways. All of that made us think of his debut film, Brick, which also subverts a murder mystery trope and recreates it for a new era. In Brick, Joseph Gordon-Levitt stars as a modern-day high school student navigating a noir-style murder mystery in the mode of Dashiell Hammett, complete with hard-bitten private eye dialogue and familiar tropes and character types. It's a terrific movie, but it also makes a terrific bookend with Knives Out. So we'll look at two Rian Johnson movies that upend old tropes and tell compelling murder stories coming up over the next couple of weeks.
In the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of Kramer vs. Kramer, Marriage Story, and anything else film-related you'd like to talk about. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may post your response on Facebook for discussion or read it on a future episode of the show. Finally, before closing out this week's episode, where can we find everybody these days? Tasha?
I am the film and TV editor at Polygon.com. Still trying to find time to actually write over there, but I've got a bunch of stuff coming up that I've lined up, and I'm going to have to start writing it one of these days. You can find me on Twitter at Tasha Robinson. Scott, what about you?
You can find me on Twitter at Scott_Tobias. You can find my work in the New York Times, NPR, Vulture. I've written a lot for The Guardian lately, including a piece on Song of the South.
You're the retrospective king.
I'm the retrospective king. It's such a great assignment, so I'm very grateful for the Guardian to keep giving me these anniversary retrospective pieces to write, because they're a lot of fun. I'm also the editor-in-chief of Oscilloscope's Musings blog, and I want to call your attention again to the two-volume Musings anthology featuring some of the best work that we've run on the site over the last 4 years. It's available in beautiful limited edition versions with original artwork. It's a great looking package, and you know, I just give some of my favorite writers, including Keith Phipps, you know, free reign to just do whatever the hell they want, and that's worked out well. So there's a lot of nice little idiosyncratic corners that we're covering with these books.
These would not make good Christmas presents for the film lover in your life.
They? Yeah, they would.
Oh, they would. Okay, well, yeah. They're good.
Maybe, please do. So, yeah, I think if you can go straight to the store at oscilloscope.net and find the books there.
Our absentee co-host Genevieve Kosky is the deputy TV editor at Vulture, and you can find her on Twitter at Genevieve Kosky. And as for me, I'm a freelance writer and occasionally editor, not so much lately, but I write for a bunch of places. I write for The Ringer. I write for Vulture. I write for Fangoria. I write for Polygon sometimes. You can find me all over the place. You can find me at Twitter at KFIPS3000. You can stay updated on The Next Picture Show by visiting nextpictureshow.net, via Twitter at nextpicturepod, and via Facebook at facebook.com/nextpictureshow. You can also contribute to our Patreon and get bonus content at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. And if you haven't subscribed to the show on Apple Podcasts already, please consider it. Apple Podcast subscriptions are an important part of getting podcasts more prominence and more listeners. And while you're there, we appreciate every rating and review. Every thumbs up helps us find new listeners and keep the show going. Thanks to Dan the Snake Jakes for his assistance producing this podcast. The Next Picture Show is a proud part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts. Please tune in next time.